Just off the north bank of the Charles River in Cambridge sit a number of public benches, one every 100 feet or so dotting up the river. If you happen to sit down on one, the only company you might find is the person sharing that very same bench, if in fact there is anyone. Everyone else will either be too far away that you couldn't speak with them without yelling, or in too much of a hurry as they walked by you to get to a class or to a job or to some appointment with their dentist or therapist. Their distance and pace serve as opposites to proximity and proclivity, two elements of good conversation. If it is winter, then you will see even fewer people and have fewer chances for dialogue. If it is winter, or even sometimes in spring and autumn, you will want to bring something warm around you, a coat, scarf, gloves, wool hat, and perhaps something warm to drink, a coffee or hot cider from one of those vendors in and around Harvard Square. It can get cold along the Charles, and you would want to be prepared. You might be waiting there for a long time. Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Salzburg, Austria, at Radio Fabrik. Tonight we look for the Argentine author Jorge Luis Borges on a park bench along the Charles River in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we speak with Bill Richardson, a Borges scholar, who helps us make connections between the literature of Borges and the concept of space. So stay tuned tonight. Proves to be a good one. I can't say now I remember which bench it was, the one in the story or the one I sat on. I'm writing this almost 7 years after I sat there myself, almost 44 years since he sat there. I looked around and tried to guess and choose the right one. I wanted to be inviting to the stranger who would hopefully share some of his conversation with me. As I walked around feeling out the potential of each bench, I started to find myself far from the movement of people. The fact I liked the quiet wasn't a recluse was reflected even in my potential choice of benches. The off in the distant sound of human footsteps over the packed snow produced nostalgia for me, a reluctant Yankee from the borderlands between suburban and rural New England. But maybe it wouldn't for a cosmopolitan porteño from Buenos Aires. But I had to ask myself, though, where would he have sat in his melancholy? Looking across the river, I wondered, what was his sight really like in those days? Could he see across to Boston? Maybe he would like the noise up closer, just out of the way of the high foot traffic, but not too far as to be totally isolated from people, even if they were not really there. It was a cold December morning for me and for Borges, a cold morning in February. I had left the hostel near Fenway after a quick but warm shower around 8 a.m. I hopped on the T and headed over to Cambridge. I went first to Harvard Square to get breakfast, two eggs, an order of home fries, and some coffee. I had a copy of the story folded into the pages of my notebook and read it again to remember any geographical details he had outlined. I read them like they were notes mapping out a pilgrimage route. I'd been carrying the story with me for some time, a couple of years of sitting with it, sitting on benches in different places, wondering if I would meet him. In the first paragraphs of this story, The Other, Borges revealed that the incident occurred in February 1969 in Cambridge. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. I was sitting comfortably on a bench beside the Charles River. I finished my coffee and asked for one to go. I had a few minutes, but I wanted to arrive at the Charles by 9:30 a.m., to get myself situated, to find the bench, to sit down and watch the river and think of time passing by. Borges is Jorge Luis Borges, an Argentine writer who, in 1967 and 8, while delivering the Charles Eliot Norton lectures at Harvard, lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts with his wife, Elsa. Elsa and Borges were married earlier in 1967 in Buenos Aires, shortly after she had been left widowed after a 27-year marriage to Ricardo Albarracín. Borges had never been married and was in his mid-60s when his aging mother, entering her 90s, raised the question of who would take care of him as his blindness progressed and as she could no longer do so. To have a woman in his life would be the solution, and Elsa, someone he had actually dated before she was married, was an ideal candidate. Their marriage was still new when they moved to Cambridge and reportedly clouded over from the start. It only lasted 3 years. The Other is a story I first encountered in the Andrew Hurley translation of the Collected Fictions. In it, Borges depicts an incident involving himself sitting alone on a bench on the Cambridge side of the Charles when a young man, a younger Borges, as a teen in Geneva in Switzerland, where he spent his youth, sits down next to him, engaging in dialogue that explored his, the younger's, youthful aspirations in order to find some clues to his, the older's, then current despair. Borges recounts this meeting of the two in two different places, Geneva and Cambridge, and two different times, 1918 and 1969, and proves to both characters the existence of this time-space collage through an exchange of Swiss coins and U.S. dollars. In the 2004 biography of Borges, Borges: A Life, Edwin Williamson comments on the emotional landscape evident through the scene in Cambridge. He says, "Only the most acute estrangement from his own past could have inspired such a story. But as his marriage to Elsa began to fail, it seemed that even his past life was more real than the present, which was so empty, so insubstantial, so unbearable." If religious pilgrimage is about a journey to a sacred or holy site or center and a way towards a life-changing experience, be it subtle or dramatic, then literary pilgrimage might take us along the paths of the writer and his characters, to those places written about or written for, those imaginative places on the map that produce new imaginings for the reader, new sacred spaces of refuge and understanding. My reading of Borges' The Other invited me to look at benches more often and who sits on them, and to think of the metaphysics of my other selves roaming around out there. I roamed around. I could only imagine that they did too, even if only as memories or apparitions, even if only through the voices of other people, those strangers I meet on the benches. The Other was my favorite of his works for this play between times and places and for how it freed up my spatially limited Puritan imagination. My pilgrimage was a literary one, but part of a longer trip that I had embarked on, riding the train throughout the East, stopping at cities for a few days, figuring out what I wanted to do next in my life, where I wanted to live next. I went first to Atlanta for turkey, sweet potatoes, and pecan pie for Thanksgiving, New Orleans to cross on the ferry to Algiers Point and get lost in the great meandering of Old Muddy, all while watching Pennsylvania and Missouri drain downriver, Chicago for no reason at all, Rochester, New York to do historical ethnography on my family, specifically the great-great-great-aunt who held a seance in Lincoln's White House, Montreal for two reasons, one, to climb Mount Royal in the snow, and two, to walk at dusk and study how the sunlight tucks itself away into night, shining and dimming on the snow-white sidewalks, Quebec City for the bone-chilling cold and to feel othered in French, Halifax because ever since I was a minor league hockey fan, the Halifax Skipjacks and the Cape Breton Oilers, I wanted to see Nova Scotia, and Boston to go sit on this bench, his bench. I had no other reason to be in Boston. I have family there, but I went to sit with Borges. The night before the bench encounter along the Charles, I had a pint at an old Irish pub near the hostel. I can't remember the name of it or if I went alone or with other travelers in from places like Germany or Japan. I liked quiet pints, so it wouldn't have mattered to me to go alone. It would have been an early night anyways. The night before Borges met his younger self on this bench, he presented what was the fourth of his six lectures, Word, Music, and Translation. I have to admit, this is the one I enjoy the least. I like The Riddle of Poetry much better, the lecture he gave in October, his first. Borges' Norton lectures became collectively known as This Craft of Verse, and the transcripts later appeared in print in the audio and CD through Harvard University Press in 2000. I play those CDs in the car on road trips, while cleaning the house, and when I want to engage with what he called the time-honored perplexities. I'm always astonished at the man who recites works from Schopenhauer and Cervantes without the aid of notes. He always cites obscure references, too, I assume only recognizable by a literate few. One is the medieval German minstrel, Walter von der Vogelweide. Ah, the way he pronounces his name. By 1968, Borges' progressive blindness had made it so that he could not read his notes anymore. Knowing this, I enjoy hearing him speak, thinking about his silences and his pauses, about his imagination and his poetics, all imprinted on his mind, spoken from inside and not from the pages of notes. I've recently heard James Joyce on the Paul Miller compilation, Rhythm Science, reading from Finnegan's Wake, and I will never read him the same again. His voice fits his writing, and the rhythm of his writing paces his voice. This isn't the case for everyone. I've heard Kerouac doing a duo with a saxophone with much less excitement. But perhaps I'm just less excited about Jack these days. My literary pilgrimages also took me from his Lowell, Massachusetts childhood home and an inevitable gravestone to the St. Petersburg, Florida house where he lived when he died. I remember asking myself after I got off the bus I took from downtown St. Pete, out past the bars he frequented in Midtown, what am I doing here? What was I doing looking at where Jean, as it says on his grave, drank himself to death? I found Kerouac, too, on the fourth day of a three-day bender, walking along Larimer Street in Denver, and later drunk on Bleecker going to hear jazz. Literary pilgrim or not, I wasn't sure if I was going to meet Borges there or my own self. Part of me wanted to meet future Kevin on that bench, the octogenarian who might laugh at all the options for my geographical destinations and then just ask me about women instead, or about ideas, or ideas I had about women. I would have had so many questions for him. I would have questions for Borges, too, if he sat down to talk. I would ask him how writing became not just the thing he did, but his craft. I would ask him why he thought the Spanish named the bay into which the Rio de la Plata flows after St. Brendan, a 6th-century Irish sailor monk. I would have closed my eyes and listened to him speak, listened to his intellectual reverie, listened to the pacing of his speech, curious about his mind. I would have asked if he had met other pilgrims at this bench over the years. By noon, no one had sat down next to me. I took a quick exit from the river for lunch, a hot pumpkin soup and artisanal bread on one of the streets heading north towards Harvard. Still cold, I walked back to the same empty bench with a hot coffee and sat down, recommencing my vigil and thinking more about this story. I first read The Other when I moved back home after living in South America for nearly 5 years during my post-college 20s. I missed my life there and questioned what and where home was for me anymore. I read or reread some of the writers I found along the way, Garcia Marquez, Neruda, and of course Borges, to summon up the spirit of that time. Borges always intrigued me partly because an older friend I had in Buenos Aires, who spoke highly of him, confided in me that she really didn't understand his work, that while everyone in Capital Federal, from Borges' own Palermo to La Boca, revered him, few understood what he was actually saying. I liked the fact that she didn't get him, and I thought I was up to the challenge of understanding his motivations and the trajectories he offered to his reader. I liked Borges' metaphysics. I started with a small collection of pieces. I called them pieces because I don't want to assume anything by calling them essays or short stories. Called for his English readership Dream Tigers. Why bother writing a whole tome when you can say it all in but a few pages? Borges showed me that. I then read other collections, Labyrinths, The Aleph, and other stories. Having previously read mostly American writers, Borges proved to open a door for me that I didn't even know existed. Borges might agree that events, like people, are not islands. His story didn't happen in isolation. saying that I sat on the bench alone would be a limited reading of the text, too. I waited and waited for a Borges or Elder Kevin, and I still can't say whether one of them presented himself. I might have missed him. While I was consciously too literal in my interpretation, I wanted to cover all my bases. I'd been looking at the benches for a couple of years and was frustrated with the limited dialogue I was finding on them. I thought I should go to the bench from the story in the wintertime. While that day I turned into night and the cold seeped through my woolens and under my dry, chapped skin down to the bones, it was still not as brutal as Quebec at midday. But I stayed there holding the vigil. I wanted to be thorough, even if that only meant putting in time on the bench by the river. If this time-space collage actually exists, where my body from an earlier and later part of my life and my present body find each other, then why not there on the bench where Borges met the other? Wouldn't that be poetic? Wouldn't that be a pilgrimage site? I was on Borges' bench. Maybe it was me who, like my friend from Buenos Aires, didn't really get him. I don't know if I wanted to meet him or some literary intellectual like him that would share with me some magic password to a life of letters. A higher probability of such an encounter or incident exists in the vicinity of MIT and Harvard and the dozens of other colleges in Beantown. No, really, maybe I should have asked myself when choosing the bench, where would I sit in my late life joy? Maybe there I would have found my 80-year-old, the one who would poke fun at my impoverished solitude while still offering something, a password perhaps, to unlock my pause, my being stuck with a decision. But maybe I don't find joy later in my life. Or maybe my bench isn't along the Charles or the Connecticut or the Housatonic, for that matter. Maybe my bench, or I should say our bench, is along the Rio de la Plata, the Paraná, or the Paraguay, where it isn't as cold as Cambridge most, if not all, times of the year. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is an hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. This public geography project presents a geographical or spatial way of thinking about our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. Each episode takes a theme, or perhaps a question, and explores it through an interactive dialogue with different texts and voices. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. Bill Richardson is professor of Spanish at the National University of Ireland, Galway. Previously, he was senior lecturer in Spanish at Dublin City University, and he's been a visiting professor at numerous universities in Spain, Latin America, the UK, and the USA. He has published on Spanish language, translation and linguistics, contemporary Spanish society, and a number of modern Spanish and Latin American authors. Currently, his research is focused mainly on the study of literary and linguistic issues of relevance to space. And we invite him here on the show tonight to discuss his book, Borges in Space, and help us to make those connections and perhaps sit a little closer to Borges on his bench and explore how literature in general informs our geographical imagination. And he joins us today from Galway. And I'd like to start with reading On Rigors and Science, a short piece by Borges that makes very explicit connections with the world of geographical thinking. On Rigor and Science. In that empire, the art of cartography reached such perfection that the map of one province alone took up the whole of a city, and the map of the empire, the whole of a province. In time, those unconscionable maps did not satisfy, and the colleges of cartographers set up a map of the empire, which had the size of the empire itself, and coincided with it point by point. Less addicted to the study of cartography, succeeding generations understood that this widespread map was useless, and not without impiety, they abandoned it to the inclemencies of the sun and of the winters. In the deserts of the West, some mangled ruins of the map lasted on, inhabited by animals and beggars. In the whole country, there are no other relics of the disciplines of geography. And he signs it Suarez Miranda, Viajes de Varones Prudentes, Book 4, Chapter 45, Lérida, 1658. So what is Borges kind of introducing us to here in this short piece, a little short essay perhaps, called On Rigor and Science?
I think what he's doing for us there is drawing our attention to something which in effect someone like Martin Heidegger in the modern era drew our attention to, which was the fact that we are situated in the world. And it is in relationship to that world around us that we live. And part of what makes us unique as human beings is that very capacity that we have to somehow grasp hold of that world, or at least to have the illusion that we may be able to grasp hold of that world. And this is done through representation. It's done much of the time through language, and Borges is very aware of that. But he's also fascinated by maps, and in a sense by the idea that something like a map can operate in the way that language can operate, which is to represent the world for us. So this piece is fascinating because it addresses that very issue of how we grasp hold of the world, what we do in order to represent the world to ourselves. And of course, the challenge is, in a sense, the challenge of the ineffable, of that which can't be expressed and that which can't be represented. We are challenged to grasp hold of the world and to explain the world to ourselves. And the map is a great symbol of that. A labyrinth is another symbol of it, of course. And these are ways of getting across the idea that the world is a complex place, and we try and explain it to ourselves. And one of the features of us as human beings is that we have knowledge of that challenge, the knowledge of the challenge of how to express our relationship to that which is around us. And this little text does that. It introduces us to that topic. And of course, it presents the idea that the ultimate description, the ultimate map of the territory would be the territory itself. But it also draws our attention to that huge difference between the thing itself and the representation of the thing. So this idea of reality out there, the universe, whatever it might be, and the map which attempts to tell us about that place, that is what's at the core of that. In a sense, it's quite similar to other tropes and other images that Borges presents to us in his writings, such as labyrinths. I mean, he's famous for drawing attention to labyrinths and being fascinated by labyrinths.
On one hand, with the On Rigor and Science, we have, you know, there's this age-old sort of saying, the map is the territory or the map is not the territory, and that sort of debate. And that representation that you're talking about, it's almost 1 inch by 1 inch trying to sort of mirror that. But then he has this story, the Aleph, that this isn't trying to represent. I mean, is this a node that describes the whole? Is this a one point that the whole runs through? How is that different, I guess, than the inch by inch?
May I read a little bit from the core of the story, right from the heart of the story, the Aleph? I have a little quotation here which
Okay.
Gets across the idea, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
He says, I saw the Aleph from every angle, and in the Aleph I saw the earth, and in the earth I saw again the Aleph, and in the Aleph the earth. I saw my face and my bowels, I saw your face, and I felt dizzy, and I cried, because my eyes had seen that secret conjectural object, whose name is usurped by men, but that no man has ever seen, the inconceivable universe.
Hmm.
Now, the universe is inconceivable, of course, in the sense that we can't grasp the entirety of the universe, and in the sense that entirety doesn't exist for us ever. And yet we have an idea of it. We have, you know, as human beings, we have the capacity to imagine the notion of an entire universe. That has to be one of the unique features of us as human beings, that capacity to imagine eternity and the entire universe, an infinity, a world which is infinite. And of course, while what happens in the story, the Aleph, is that the protagonist has this moment when he sees an orb in which he can see scenes of everything, and then he presents the fact that in order to describe it, he has to use human language. So while he can see something in an instant, something which is instantaneous, and he can grasp it in an instant, on the other hand, in order to describe it, he needs human language. And human language can only operate in time, so that human language operates sequentially. And the challenge then is to describe in words something which is grasped in that kind of moment, in that instant. It is a kind of allegory of a mystical experience, a mystical apprehension of everything that there is in the world. But as human beings, we are challenged by these realities because, of course, while we can on some level imagine the existence of what we call the universe, on the other hand, in order to represent it, in order to describe it, we are, as it were, bound by temporality. We are unable to convey in an instant what has to be conveyed over time.
Hmm.
So, in a sense, the story, the Aleph, leads up to that peculiar sensation of that notion of infinity. One of the famous geographers of modern times, Edward Soja,
right,
makes reference to it in a book of his called Postmodern Geographies. And he called the Aleph an allegory on the infinite complexities of space and time. Of course, what that story does, and what many Borges' stories do, is that they bring back to us an awareness of the nature of space, the nature of space and the nature of time, the nature of the universe in that sense, that we are able to conceive in an abstract way of the world and the universe, while at the same time being creatures who live in an immediate proximity to the world and an awareness of everyday surroundings. And of course, you know, in the Aleph, as in other stories by Borges, we have lots of descriptions of an ordinary house in Buenos Aires and his meeting with the person in the house and what goes on and so forth. It's kind of an everydayness about that kind of description. And then into that intrudes this peculiar kind of quasi-mystical experience, which hints at the idea of that capacity that we have as human beings to imagine abstraction, to imagine infinities, to imagine eternities, to imagine something which is much wider and broader than anything that we experience on an everyday basis. So in a sense, while we can say that, you know, Borges' stories operate at a level of abstraction that's unusual, at the same time, what he's reminding us of all the time is the very human capacity that we have to do that kind of thing. It is one of the things that makes us unique as human beings, that we are able to challenge ourselves intellectually to try and appreciate the way the world is in that broader sense.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website. Or go to the blog and enter into the conversation. So on one hand, we have that abstract representation, and on the other hand, we have this sort of the phenomenology of the lived space. Is that kind of...
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and several of his stories, the major stories of Borges, conveyed that idea. There's a brilliant little story called Death on the Compass, La Muerte y la Brújula, which is set in Buenos Aires, and, you know, it's a detective fiction, basically, because there are some murders that take place, and you have this very intellectual detective who's trying to figure out the solution to this mystery in the way that you would with an Edgar Allan Poe story or whatever. And in that story, one of the features of the story is the use of a map of Buenos Aires, the way in which the detective figures out what's going on, or at least partially figures it out, is because he has sent a map showing where the murders are taking place in the city of Buenos Aires. And he's able to follow that and follow the sequence of events in terms of the time interludes between them, the 1 month between the various murders taking place. And he's able to go to the place where the next murder is, the last murder in the sequence is due to take place. And of course, what he doesn't know, and this is the cleverness of the story itself, is that he's the intended victim, because the person who sent him the map is deliberately luring him into that place in order that he can kill him,
right,
because he wants to get revenge on him. But you see, one of the things that happens in that story is that when the detective goes to the places, the crime scenes where these murders take place, there is a sense of those locations being depicted as ordinary locations that we experience, you know, seeing the colors and the smells and the sights and so forth of that particular location. So we get a sense of the kind of location that it is. But at the same time, the introduction of the map, or the idea of the map, allows us to have that other more abstract sense of a kind of bird's eye view of an overall map of the place.
Right.
So on the one hand, we experience it in the kind of immediate, and on the other hand, we experience it in the abstract. And of course, that's what we as human beings are good at, that combination of abstraction and concreteness. And Borges manages to draw our attention to that in a little story like, as I say, Death on the Compass.
So why then the labyrinth? What does the labyrinth do for Borges, and what does it do for the reader?
Borges always associated the labyrinth with the idea of what he called in Spanish asombro. And asombro is like amazement or puzzlement or a combination of both. And, you know, Borges had this kind of modesty, and he used to humbly say, look, I really don't understand the world. I don't understand the universe. And what I find is that I'm puzzled by it. And I think, you know, that's a very human feeling. We all are puzzled by the mysteries of the universe in that sense. And this is, I think, what Borges does, that he tentatively concocts thought experiments in which he explores how amazing the world is. And the way, of course, if you like, the way in which he uses those things quite often is to try and imagine some extreme version of some basic idea.
Yeah.
For example, the idea of immortality. He has a story called The Immortal One, in which he imagines a person who cannot die. You know, or perhaps the most famous Borges story, which is a wonderful thought experiment, which is The Library of Babel. And of course, in that, what you have is a library which is composed of every possible book that can be put together using the 26 letters of the alphabet, and where each book is, you know, 410 pages long and 40 lines on each page and so forth, where you just combine all those characters together in every possible combination. And so it's the famous idea of, if you put monkeys at typewriters typing away, eventually they'll produce the works of Shakespeare. And of course, the idea of this Library of Babel is that, you know, every single book that it's possible to imagine is there in that library. Now, Borges takes that idea and he, as it were, explores it in the story. So not much happens in the story. It's not a kind of normal plot that happens in the story, but rather it's an exploration of that thought experiment around what would it be like to have a situation where every single book that you could imagine is written. Because, after all, if every single book is there, then there are books that will explain an awful lot, that might explain the meaning of life, that might explain how the universe works. And, of course, the problem is that most books would be fairly nonsensical because they'd be just random collections of different characters from the alphabet. And so what Borges presents to us is this image of this universe that is not infinitely large, because after all, the number of combinations of these letters is limited, but it's such a big number, it's such a monstrously large number, that it may as well be infinite from our point of view. In fact, when you calculate, and mathematicians have, of course, calculated this kind of thing, when you calculate the number of such books that would exist if such a library existed, you get a number which is something like 25 to the power of 1.3 million. And that's an absolutely monstrous number. It's a number which is so big that it's more than all the atoms of the known universe. So, you know, such a collection of books wouldn't probably fit in the universe that we know. It's that large. And if that's the case, then, of course, trying to find any particular book in this library is virtually impossible, because nearly every book that you come across will just be meaningless gibberish. And of course, that's, in a sense, a great allegory for the kind of puzzlement that we find ourselves in the world, where we don't understand what's going on.
Right.
This notion of asombro is at the basis of it. That library, if you like, is a kind of a labyrinth, but it's a labyrinth which contains such an enigmatic puzzle in it that it's impossible to figure it out.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. There's another story that kind of, I think, challenges our ideas of time space. And it's called The Other, and it finds a young Jorge Luis Borges on a bench in Geneva, and I think in the 19-teens, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
Yeah, and then the older Borges in on a bench in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
In 1968,
69. And it's told, if you like, from the perspective of the older Borges, who meets up with this person when he's sitting on a bench in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1969. He suddenly sees and starts talking to this person, a younger person beside him, who, you know, states that where he is in Geneva in the early 20th century. And of course, it is the young Borges who did live in Geneva in the early 20th century. And again, it's a kind of science fiction story or a thought experiment where the universe of the younger Borges meets the universe of the older Borges.
Right.
And the two come together, and the kind of difficulties associated with that are very human difficulties. You know, it is a very human story in that sense of the longing to be able to communicate and the inability to communicate with your younger self. The things that you know and yet can't change about the world. I mean, in a sense, that is a story which, in a way, exemplifies the kind of idea that Bush was fascinated with, which was the notion of parallel universes, which nowadays we take as part and parcel of scientific knowledge, and it's associated with quantum theory and so forth, and multiverses, ever since the 1950s.
Right.
But Borges, you know, thought of that idea and used it in stories even before then. And of course, this is the notion that there are several realities. There's an infinite, potentially infinite number of different realities that are taking place each time when options are available to us. And this is famously depicted in his story, The Garden of Forking Paths. Again, that's one that he's very famous for, which he wrote in the early in the 1940s, long before the idea of the multiverses came in scientifically, right, in the 1950s. But of course, in the Borges story, The Garden of Forking Paths, what you had was a story about an ancient Chinese man who went off into the hills and said he was going to create a labyrinth and write a novel. And of course, I mean, there's a lot more to it than that. There are other aspects to the story that set it in the period of the First World War. But the key notion that it harks back to is this idea of the labyrinth that was created in by this old Chinese scholar and the novel that he wrote. And of course, what happens is that the novel and the labyrinth turned out to be the one thing. And the novel is structured in such a way that every time there's more than one outcome possible to some event, then each of those outcomes is explored in a different chapter. And so the novel looks chaotic on the surface, right, but what it's doing is trying to be a representation of a world in which there are parallel universes. So every time there are different options to something taking place. For instance, if one person attacks another, then both of them might survive, or one might kill the other, or the second one might kill the first, and so forth. Those are all the various possible options at that particular moment in a sequence of events. And in this novel that the Chinese scholar creates, he actually creates chapters which describe each of those outcomes, and then each of those outcomes in turn has different possibilities for continuing on. And you get this kind of forking of events through time. So the labyrinth ends up being a temporal labyrinth, represented to some extent in this novel. It's not a spatial labyrinth. But again, this is a kind of thought experiment on the part of Borges. He, as it were, invites us to speculate on what that might be like.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. So why then is Borges so important to geography, and why is geography so important to Borges?
So Borges was actually, you know, quite interested in and fascinated by geography. At one stage, he actually said, one should not dismiss geography. It may be no less important than psychology. So the idea that where you are is important is one that's fundamental in Borges.
So it's not right. So if we're using psychology, not just the study of the psyche of the of who we are, maybe even in older terms, study of the soul, but where that soul is, where that person is in the world, and our place in the universe, right?
That's it. And you know, it's isn't it a way of, as it were, drawing our attention to the fact that perspective is all important. We will see the world from our own particular perspective. So, you know, whether that has to do with the national culture that we feel we belong to, whether it has to do with a particular social group that we feel part of, and all of these other aspects, those, in a sense, are ways of locating ourselves, ways of putting ourselves into a particular perspective in relation to the world. And that's how we understand the world. That's how, you know, we give meaning to the actions that we actually undertake.
Yeah, so we're looking, I guess, in terms of what we talk about here, the geographical imagination, we could say in many ways our nations, our culture, our society's shape and structure, our geographical imagination. There's a collective one out there. But at the same time, we do have this individual one. And maybe Borges would say something like, each of us individually has our own symbols, right?
That's right. And, you know, our symbolic interpretations of the world around us, these things have to do with the ways in which we associate with particular collectivities, the perspective that we have on things.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I said, often what he reminds us of is the fact of these dichotomies that exist within us and which we actually carry around with us all the time. Now, what I'm talking about there is, for instance, the dichotomy between the notion of an individual and the notion of a collective. We are both of those things, and at the same time, the dichotomy between the abstract and the concrete. You know, we are both abstract and concrete beings at the same time, and we have the capacity to switch between the perspective of the abstract and the perspective of the concrete, and between an individual perspective and a collective perspective. And it's often in those switches that we make particular meanings.
And we're able to then kind of arrive at a better understanding of the structures, basically, our thought structures.
And a more comprehensive understanding of, you know, the way we are.
Yeah.
And how we, again, getting back to Heidegger, how we are in the world, how we relate to that world around us. Not just that we are located in it, but rather that we have meaningful, you know, engagement with it in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, is this about spatial consciousness? Is that ultimately sort of the being aware and conscious of first off, that space sort of exists, but then ourselves in that space?
That's right. And, you know, I do think that that is something that Borges, but a lot of literature, draws our attention to.
Yeah.
It is this sense that we have that we are able to know that there is the broader perspective. So, yes, we can see things from the particular perspective that we're in, but we're also able to stand back and take the bird's eye view of things. And, you know, that may be one of the features that makes us unique as human beings.
Well, great. Thank you for sharing all these insights with us on the show on geographical imaginations. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Kevin. Thank you.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website, or go to the blog and enter into the conversation. And I leave you tonight with the quote that best captures, I think, the spirit of this show. In fact, might have even been one of the motivators, one of the initial framings of the show. And it comes from Borges in his epilogue, signed Buenos Aires, October 31st, 1960. And it's in the book Dream Tigers, the English translation, by Mildred Boyer and Harold Moreland. And he says, "A man sets himself the task of portraying the world. Through the years, he peoples a space with images of provinces, kingdoms, mountains, bays, ships, islands, fishes, rooms, instruments, stars, horses, and people. Shortly before his death, he discovers that that patient labyrinth of lines traces the image of his face." Thanks. Stay tuned till next time. Ciao.